The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
The number you have dialed has not been recognised.
Oh, fuck off.
Please check and try again.
Oh, shit. Try again, Chris. Get your fat fingers on it again.
I just press redial. Hello, can I speak to Mr. Zaltzman in room 7, please?
Hello, Buglers, and yes! Welcome to episode 146 of The Bugle, the world's only remaining reliable source of news. Not my words, the words of UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Although he might have been talking about something else, and he might not have used the word news. Let me think. I wasn't news. No, it was high-class dried apricots. He's coming back to me now. It wasn't The Bugle, it was David Hasselhoff, the last remaining source of high-class dried apricots. Actor, composer, role model, and fruit dealer to the great and famous. I am Andy Zaltzman, live in Colombo. Any guesses? Oh, sorry, that was supposed to be the other way around. I'm so bad at building up tension. And joining me live from wherever the f*** he is this week, is it New York? It's Sergeant yes. Satire himself, John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. And Andy, you probably didn't hear the hold music. Went through the operator there. It sounds like a Nintendo game from the early 90s. It's a little plinky-plonky keyboard music, and then when your voice comes through at the end, it's like basically you're the end-of-level monster that's about to try and decapitate Mario.
Well, that's how I like to think of myself.
Andy, there are photos that last a lifetime, and you definitely sent me one this week. Andy sent me a photo with Harbhajan Singh, MS Dhoni, who two of the most famous cricketers in the world, sitting with Andy's little homemade WG Grace doll. And the look on Harbhajan Singh's face was absolutely incredible. He was definitely happy, but he was also understandably confused. You could see him thinking, hold on, I'm Harbhajan Singh, one of the greatest spin bowlers in the world. I am the Turbinator. Why is this British man showing me his WG Grace doll? And why do I now want to steal it from him with all my might? This truly wasn't the day that I, Harbhajan Singh, thought I was getting when I woke up this morning.
That's pretty much what he said to me as well. It was a kind of bizarre occurrence. It was a book launch for a little book of cartoons of the Indian players that I wrote the text for. And I thought I'll give WG Grace, who for our American listeners, you should know who he is. He's part of the world's heritage, not just British heritage. He was a 19th century cricket legend, the man who made modern cricket. And my sister made me a doll of him a few years ago. I thought I'd take it around with me and try to get photos of famous cricketers with him. And so I gave him to the Indian captain, MS Dhoni, who is, you know, one of the most famous men in India. And he sat there waving his little arm around. He's very pleased with it.
He obviously knew who WG Grace was.
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
I took him out and said, oh, it's WG. Fair play to him. So he was a very good sport about it. So I'm going to try and get more famous cricketers with WG. I'll put the photo up on the Bugle Twitter feed, the Hello Buglers.
I was trying to explain to someone at work, I was showing them the picture and they were saying, oh, who are those two guys? And I said, well, those are two cricketers, not just any cricketers. If you showed this photo to anyone from India, Sri Lanka, or basically anywhere in that region of the world, people would shit themselves.
But, yeah, I got in the paper. Sadly, WG Grace did not get in the paper.
What paper?
A few of the Indian papers had pictures of the book launch. So I was standing there for MS Dhoni, who earns more money in advertising endorsements in a day than I will earn from everything I do in my lifetime. Feeling pretty much as you felt when you shook hands with George Clooney, John. Distinctly unphotogenic and a little bit out of shape.
He is a very handsome man, MS Dhoni. And I can see that he was wearing a Ferrari hat as well. I'm guessing he has the car to go with the cap.
Yeah, I think he's got a fleet of cars. So, This is the Bugle 146. 146, of course, a little red book by the French adventure writer Jules Verne, a follow-up to his blockbusting smash hit Around the World in 80 Days about Phileas Fogg's next journey, which was sadly cut short by a particularly nasty vomiting bug. Hence, 146, subtitled 10 Pukes a Day for a Fortnight, Why Not to Eat Corn Burritos in Sub-Saharan Africa? This is for the week beginning Monday, the 7th of March, 2011, meaning it's the 135th anniversary of the day that Alexander Graham Bell was granted a patent for the telephone, beating the Italian Antonio Meucci to it by 4 hours. As a result, all telephones were designed with a bell inside in honour of Alexander Graham Bell. If Meucci had got his paperwork done sooner, all telephones would have had a barking dog inside, because Meucci, as you don't need me to tell you, is the Italian word for Labrador. As always, a section of Bugle is going straight in the bin this week. Celebrities and their fears, including actor Brian Cox is convinced he is sexually attractive to wolves and has never been to Canada, just in case he meets one there. The 82-year-old Russian Nobel Prize-winning science geek and theoretical physics magazine's Hunk of the Year, Alexei Abrikosov, is petrified of being left alone in a shopping mall and has not bought any new clothes for 25 years as a result. South African golfer extraordinaire Retief Goosen won't eat mushrooms in case his head swells up like mushrooms' heads do. And whenever Chinese President Hu Jintao plays snooker, he makes sure the owner of the snooker club plays a best-of-five-frame match with his bodyguard to make sure none of the balls explode. And more of that in the bin this week.
Andy, I cannot believe that you said the name Retief Goosen without doing it in a South African accent.
Retief! Yeah! Retief! Where is Ernie Alls? Yeah! My name is Retief! I play golf! Yeah!
It's quite hard to say the word Retief without sounding a little bit South African.
Top story this week, Jews news! Andy, this is huge. Pope Benedict is set to announce in a new book next week that Jewish people are, wait for it, not responsible for the death of Jesus. Not guilty, Andy! Not guilty! It's like the OJ trial all over again, except this time you actually didn't commit the murder. Congratulations! This must be a massive relief for you.
Well, it's huge, John. You know, we're off the hook. I mean, a couple of thousand years late, but, better late than never, I guess. I mean, well, for a start, it's a surprise it's taken people so long to get over it. It was just one guy, you know, and, you know, he'd have died anyway. Plus, it was a bloody good career move for the lad as well. So many have copied him since to boost flagging popularity. And the thing was, John, from Jesus' point of view, his last couple of parables have got pretty lukewarm reviews, particularly the parable of the half-eaten sandwich and the cleaning lady, and the parable of the dog with no nose, who apparently would have smelled terrible, lacking, as he would have done, the olfactory self-awareness to maintain even canine levels of hygiene. And Jesus' last miracle would end up with a man with an orange for a head and a woman with an orangutan instead of a husband. So, clearly, he was on the downward curve, John. And, you know, he's done an Elvis, basically. So, you know, it clearly wasn't our fault, John. It was his agents, if anything. But it's amazing how long the paperwork took to come through on this Jesus case. I mean, could have saved my team a lot of aggro if it hadn't fallen down the back of a filing cabinet in 35 AD. But there you go.
He's done an Elvis. Are you saying that the last years of Jesus' life, he was very much Las Vegas Jesus?
Well, you know, he wore white suits, didn't he?
Well, I suppose I can't deny there is a connection there. Now, sure, Andy, there are going to be some anti-Semites who still say, well, there have been lots of high-powered Jewish lawyers working on this case for over 2,000 years, so they were bound to force a result at some point. But I say don't listen to them, Andy. This is justice! Justice! And I guess the key question is, what now? This was a wrongful conviction, a slanderous allegation, and I think you, Andy, would be well within your rights to sue the Romans for everything you can get. Who knows how damaged your reputation has been?
Yeah, well, it's been pretty damaged. Certainly a couple of gigs I've done. Certainly, I'm pretty sure that
That's not what I'm talking about, Andy. The Anti-Defamation League said it was an important and historic moment, and it really is. It's going to force everyone to see the world in a slightly different way. Because I, for one, Andy, have known you for a long time. And I've always just assumed that you were a little bit of a murderer. And now I realise that was wrong. I was wrong. That was groundless. And this must be quite a shift for you as well. You've been living in a mental prison your entire life. Now you get to walk out into the community without that criminal record hanging over you. Do you think you'll be able to assimilate into society okay? I just hope you don't re-offend, you know, finding yourself wanting to murder someone dressed like Jesus in a nativity play just to get your identity back.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's the only life I've ever known, John. You know, I won't get back in there. So... But it's difficult. It's going to take a lot of adjustment. I think really the Jews as a people are going to need some counselling and a lot of help from society to put ourselves back on our feet, John. Yeah, the man who was to blame clearly was Jesus himself. You know, claiming ignorance of the law. You know, he was banged to rights, John. That's not an excuse. No smoke without fire. You know, lengthy charge sheet, blasphemy, claiming to be king of the Jews, being messianic in charge of a donkey. Telling soppy, feel-good, saccharine, sweet, happy-ending stories. Now, what was he doing? Trying to get a job as a Hollywood screenwriter. Oh, guess what? He's not f***ing dead. Saw it coming, Jesus. Saw it coming. So, you know, really, he put himself in the firing line.
This is just the latest in a long line of incidents of the Catholic Church correcting past wrongs, such as the exoneration of Galileo recently. It's all part of their better so late that it's basically never system of justice. This isn't entirely new. The Catholic Church has officially considered the Jews free from blame regarding Jesus' death since 1965, which, you are right, is breathtakingly recent. That was recent, Andy. In 1964, they still thought you were guilty.
And it's what? So in 1965, they decided we weren't guilty, and it's taken 46 years for the press release to come out.
That's better. You've got to be sure, Andy. You can let justice take its course. The difference here, of course, is that this comes straight from the big guy, straight from the Pope. It's basically a celebrity endorsement, and they can be very powerful. For instance, the food here in America at Taco Bell is objectively disgusting. But if a retired NBA player pretends to eat it, all of a sudden it's worth trying. And the same is true with this example. Not blaming Jewish people for murdering Jesus may not seem appetising to people at first. The Pope is just asking everyone to try it. And this might actually be a good move for him. Pope Benedict has not enjoyed the best relationship with Jewish people so far, dating back to the fact that, as an impressionable child, he was in a youth group that was in favour of their extermination. And that will cause friction, Andy. You know, if you were in a youth group that had aims to wipe John Oliver off the face of the planet, then I would probably have some concerns about that. However much you claim that it was years ago and the group was really just about increasing your own pride rather than plotting my extinction, I still think it would make me uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, it wasn't years ago, John. It was very recently, and I was considered too old for membership. So.
The Prime Minister of Israel has thanked the Pope for his words this week. Netanyahu wrote in a letter that, "I commend you for forcefully rejecting in your recent book a false charge that has been a foundation for the hatred of the Jewish people for many centuries." And apparently he even offered to give the Pope a quote to use on the front of his book, that quote being, "Finally, about f***ing time, I couldn't put it down."
Well, as a result of this, John, the Jews, by way of thanks, are apparently going to cede control of the international finance and entertainment industries. So, it's give and take.
The book is going to be published on March the 10th of this year and is called Jesus of Nazareth Part 2, which is actually an analysis of his life rather than what the title seems to promise. And that's a big letdown because Jesus of Nazareth Part 2 seems to suggest that you're basically getting Jesus of Nazareth the Revenge. Christ is back and this time he's pissed off. I thought the Pope was writing the fictionalised story of Christ coming back down to earth after he was crucified to take bloody vengeance against everyone who'd wronged him, with passages such as this. Jesus jumped from the roof, swinging through an open window and kicking the knife out of Peter's hand. "Hey, Peter, heard you denied me three times. Well, deny this," muttered our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ as he flung a ninja star deep into Peter's chest. "The Lord moves in mysterious ways," whispered the holiest of holies as he span round and kicked Peter's head clean off his neck. "Oh, Judas," screamed the Lamb of God, "come out to play." And I wasn't the only one who was misled by that title, Andy, because apparently Joel Schumacher optioned the Pope's book before it was published for $35 million. Now he has to write an action movie about the theological analysis of Christ's life. And I just don't think that Jason Statham is suited for the project anymore. Middle East update now. And, well, if there was any part of you that thought Colonel Gaddafi might do the right thing this week, then that part of you was once again bitterly disappointed. Because, once more, Gaddafi flicked his humanity switch to mute and turned his crazy dial up to 15. He spent much of this week attempting to secure the strategic oil town of Brega, which rebels are managing miraculously to hold in the face of multiple attacks from the ground and even from the air. And it is absolutely horrifying to see Gaddafi using the weapons that we sold him for purposes which, somewhere at the back of our minds, we must have worried he would use them for when we sold them to him. And it's hard to say if it's been a good week for Gaddafi or not. You know, on one hand, he's still alive, which was by no means a foregone conclusion this time last week. On the other hand, he still has no control over much of Libya, and his country is moving closer to all-out civil war. And he's even lost the silence of the White House now, as President Obama yesterday explicitly called for Gaddafi to leave, saying, "Let me just be very unambiguous about this. Colonel Gaddafi needs to step down from power and leave." To which Gaddafi said, "Let me just be very unambiguous about this. I am f***ing crazy, and I do not have the capacity to process what you just said."
He claimed this week that there had been no protests against him in Tripoli, which was some claim. I mean, it did seem to counteract the television footage that has been beamed around the world. In the same speech, he also claimed credit for Libya's win in the 2010 Ryder Cup, and declared that he was flattered by the 8 Oscars awarded to his autobiographical movie, Colonel Cutie and the Surf Babes.
Obama made a call to the Gaddafi supporters who are fighting for the colonel, saying that they should know that, I quote, "history is moving against Colonel Gaddafi." But history isn't the only thing that's moving against him, Andy. His own face is moving against him as well. During his most recent speech, his face was so puffy, it was like his own skin was trying to escape his crazy skull. His skin was thinking, "Oh boy, this dude is out of control. I am out of here." As more details emerge about Gaddafi's actions over the last few years, and yeah, by emerge, I mean people starting to pay attention to them for the first time, a few awkward questions are having to be answered by a number of pop stars. Mariah Carey was apparently paid $1 million to sing just 4 songs at a 2009 New Year's Day bash on a Caribbean island hosted by Colonel Gaddafi's son. The Gaddafis also paid huge money for personal concerts from Usher, Lionel Richie, Beyonce and Nelly Furtado. So it seems that the Gaddafi's taste in music is as bad as their taste in human rights. One by one, these artists are reluctantly claiming that they might give the money to charity. Earlier in the week, Nelly Furtado announced that she would donate the $1 million that she was paid by the Gaddafis. And if you need any more proof, Andy, that Gaddafi is insane, $1 million for Nelly Furtado? Nelly Furtado? Of all the singers that you could have flown over, Nelly Furtado. How many times can she sing "I'm Like a Bird"? Although, under the circumstances, that actually would have been a very fitting song. "I'm like a bird, in that I have absolutely no morals. I'm also like a bird, in that I can sing. But it's worth noting that I've made a conscious choice to take $1 million to perform for a despot, something that I've willfully ignored. And in that sense, I must admit, I am not like a bird."
She does shit on people's cars, apparently.
That is another way that she is like a bird.
That's why that song is one verse less long than it was originally planned to be.
I'm like a bird.
The fans are ready for it.
That is the lost verse. "I'm like a bird, I shit on people's cars."
Mariah Carey got $1 million. $1 million for 4 songs.
Yeah.
So, what was it? $2 million for 2 songs? Is this on? Is this Sri Lankan
Zing.
Telephone on?
Zing.
Is it on?
Take that, Mariah Carey. You just got zinged from Sri Lanka.
Well, world leader fashion news now, and photographs have emerged showing former Egyptian number one, Hosni Mubarak, wearing a pinstripe suit. Now, that doesn't sound too outlandish, you think. You know, a world leader in a pinstripe suit, what is so unusual about that? But if you focus in a little more closely on those pinstripes, it turns out they're not actually pinstripes. What they are is his name embroidered tinily into his jacket. So his jacket is just covered from head to toe in his own name. Now, you might think that having your name embroidered all over your suit is not perhaps showing the selfless humility you might seek in a leader. But it's clear that Hosni Mubarak was looking at the merchandise market, John.
Yes,
you know,
of course.
He's clearly thinking, you know, I've got a limited shelf life. I've got to cash in while the going is good. And, you know, he kept winning elections, so he thought it must be popular. If David Beckham can sell shirts with his name all over them, there has to be a market for Hosni Mubarak suits. Now, how many elections has David Beckham won? Not many. You know, if it's okay for Roger Federer to walk out at Wimbledon with his initials splattered all over his jacket, his shoes and his underpants, apparently, when he'd only been world number one tennis player for 6 years, why shouldn't there be a man who remained undisputed number one ranked Egyptian for 30 years? Why should he not treat himself to a little bit of me clothes? So, and think about it. How many professional tennis players are there, John? There's five. There's Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray and Henman. How many Egyptians are there? 80 million. So I know which is more impressive. Let the man have his fun with his suits.
Absolutely. He's just looked at the business model of Puff Daddy and he's thought, I admire the way that man has diversified. So he won't stop here, Andy. Yes, he's going to get his own clothing line. Don't be surprised if he has a new range of premium vodkas coming out in the future as well. It makes business sense. And other dictators really should follow suit, Andy, and get their own clothing lines. There should be a line of bespoke berets for Hugo Chavez, a line of beige sport jackets from Ahmadinejad, and a line of oversized prescription glasses from Kim Jong-il.
He might just have said to his tailor, just stick some letters all over it. I like to have something to read while I'm sitting in meetings, and it looks rude if I get my encyclopedia out. And then, you know, clearly the tailor thought, well, let's just stick the lyrics to our favourite song on it. And it just turned out that their favourite song was a song called Hosni Mubarak by the famously repetitive German post-punk electro-medical metatribal grunk pop duo Hermann und die Schlauterhunds. So let's not rule that out. I mean, it could also have been a motivational acronym, John, to help remind Hosni Mubarak to keep calm with all the pressures of leading a country, still recovering from blowing all its money on needlessly large and pointy graves to dead kings. So clearly, this acronym was, you know, in the spelling's name, with a Y for the Hosni. Heroes of strength need yachts, money, usually billions, and really ass-kicking Kalashnikovs. So maybe it's that. Maybe we should not judge him. We should not judge him, John. We've all got little bits of vanity. I have a tattoo of my own face. Admittedly, it's on my own face, so it doesn't really show up. But, you know, we shouldn't judge him too harshly.
In other Egypt news, the Egyptian army formally accepted the resignation of the recently appointed Prime Minister, Ahmed Shafik. Apparently, the removal of Shafik was a key demand of the protesters. And the interesting thing here is the announcement was made on his and the army's Facebook pages. Wow. Is that really how we're conducting international affairs now, through status updates? Ahmed Shafik is currently Prime Minister of Egypt. Oh, his status has changed. Ahmed Shafik is now no longer Prime Minister of Egypt. Sad face. Ahmed Shafik has no friends.
Very moving. Very moving. Your emails now. And this one comes in from a man who signs himself John, Lance Corporal Communications Bugle Army Outpost, Sydney.
So, at ease. At ease.
At ease. Dear John and Andy and John, in order for Colonel Gaddafi would prefer to stay with just for a few days until all this nonsense blows over. So, I don't know, obviously he can come and join me for the World Cup, but I can't get him tickets. I'm struggling to get my own one. Anyway, I've been puzzled by how these social network revolutions have been happening. Let me explain. The Bugle is distributed to a fairly small audience in South Africa. What? And you will see my point. I live in Sydney, Australia. On a weekly basis, I check iTunes for new episodes. As soon as a new one is available, I listen to the episode and laugh. Every 2 weeks, I burn the episodes to disc, one episode per disc in audio CD format, so they can be played in the CD player. I take the two CDs down to the post office and post them off to my sister in Johannesburg, where clearly they don't have the internet. At this stage, at least 2 weeks have passed, and news of the world that you've so expertly summed up is beginning to go a bit stale. After a few days, she receives them and proceeds to listen to them on her CD player and laughs. She then puts them in her handbag and takes them to her weekly bridge club meeting, where she begins distributing them to her friends. We are now at least 3, but more likely 4 weeks past breaking news ground zero. Since she has only one CD per episode, the distribution process is fairly lengthy, and her 8 or so friends will only have completed listening to both episodes in at least 12 weeks. They all laugh. You write that in a slightly sarcastic way. please note, she does not share the episodes with my mother because she thinks it is smut. Well, Lance Corporal John's mother. Anyway,
not helped your case there, Andy, one little bit.
I've been under the impression, Nick, that every family worldwide has only one technically competent person who is responsible for all things electronic within the family. That is certainly true in my family, and it is assuredly not me. Ranging from stopping the time flashing 12 o'clock on VCR to show them how to send and receive emails and reboot their computers, even if they live on another continent. A bit of bitterness coming out here. This being the case, I must then take my hat off to the people responsible for orchestrating and choreographing the message to thousands of people saying, hey, let's meet up at the square in 13 weeks' time and say, let's say, 8-ish and overthrow the government. Imagine how happy they would have been on the day when they saw all their friends heading down to the square with their picnic baskets and rocks. It must have been like Robinson Crusoe seeing a rescue ship approaching 3 years after posting a message in a bottle at the local post office of tiny island in the middle of the Pacific. Well done. Carry on. So there we go. It is pretty impressive, actually.
I like the fact that that's now how the Bugle is being distributed around certain places, basically in the similar way that the Communist Manifesto was once illicitly handed around London.
You know, I don't know if the Communist Manifesto was considered as funny as the Bugle by some.
It wasn't without laughs.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm not sure we'll be quite as influential. My great worry is that people will willfully misinterpret the teachings of the Bugle and never actually fully put into practice what it's really saying.
Right, and it will inadvertently lead to the death of hundreds of thousands of people. You're right, Andy, you're right. That is a concern.
So do keep your emails coming in. And just a quick note, feel free to try and keep them under about 300 words. It's a bit easier to read them out then. We'll have had some absolute mammoth masterworks. Epic sentence, but it's kind of hard to read them all out. So the Bugle at timesonline.co.uk. Bugle Sport now, and, well, John, it was a dark day for English sport on Wednesday. I was in Bangalore to see England somehow lose to Ireland at cricket. Now, this kind of thing is simply not supposed to happen, John. The real concern at the end of it, you know, England losing to Ireland, I guess looking for the positives, I think we can see that this was the England cricket team apologising belatedly for, you know, some of the wrongs that we may or may not have perpetrated against the Irish people.
may or may not. I don't think that's a grey area anymore.
Let's not be judgmental, John. It's taken the Pope 2,000 years to say that the Jews weren't responsible for killing Jesus. Let's not jump to conclusions about what Cromwell did in the 17th century. We don't have all the facts yet.
That's true. Let's not rush it.
But England looked like they were cruising to an easy victory. And then a player called Kevin O'Brien, who had a record as a useful player, but nothing spectacular, came in and absolutely obliterated the England bowling. He hit the ball as if he hated it. He spanked England's bowlers as if he just found them in bed with his granny. He did not just make mincemeat of England. He pulped them into a burger and fed them to his dog. And it ended up with, it was incredible. He went at it like a hippo in a haberdashery store. And it was one of the... For our American listeners, he made Mark Maguire look like a frail old woman trying to swat a fly with a newspaper. It was an astonishing display, and England were left looking more stony-faced than an Easter Island statue. And it led, of course, if you can remember from when you were British, you know, how important cricket is to our national psyche.
And, I've got echoes of a memory there.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, just I've heard from my friends back in England still that there was rioting on the streets. The Queen seen leaving Buckingham Palace in a helicopter. Chancellor George Osborne seen being chased down Whitehall in his underpants by an angry mob. I mean, that could have been coincidence. It does happen at least twice a week. Prime Minister David Cameron, always a bit of a bandwagon jumper, sighted banging on the door of the Irish embassy dressed as a leprechaun, pretending to be an IT consultant called Fergus O'Flahavan.
And in the confusion, Lord's cricket ground was kidnapped by the Russians and taken to Yekaterinburg. And we just don't know what's happened to her there. So dark days for the country. And, you know, English cricket in a bit of denial. Captain Andrew Strauss, actually in the post-match press conference, denied that the match had taken place. Said, "I've been in the cinema all day. I saw Dude, Where's My Car 3 times. So, and also, I mean, I guess, you know, let's remember, John, what we have to remember in all this is that we recently bailed out the Irish economy. We basically bought Ireland back. So basically, this was England beating England at cricket, and I think we can live with that. So, if you want to keep up with my travels around the Cricket World Cup, then look for my Zoltzman on the Road page on Crick Info, or follow my Twitter updates on at Zolt Cricket, also the Bugle Twitter feed, at Hello Buglers.
Can I read you guys quite a good tweet that has happened during the record of this?
Yes.
This is sent by Chris Gayle, West Indies captain.
Yeah.
After every sentence, I want you to picture there are 3 exclamation marks. Bangladesh stoning our bus. Freaking glass break. This is ridiculous. Damn. W Cup with so many security and this happen. Big joke. Trust me, I'm not keen here. Players lay flat.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Chris Gayle. I'm very sorry to hear that. That's Andy. Can you not do something about that? I mean, I know you're in a different country, but still.
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll try and calm him down by introducing him to a little cuddly WG Grey.
That would help. That would help.
Well, that is the flip side of Bangladesh cricket fans. I talked the week before about how amazingly enthusiastic they were. But sadly, their team was bowled out for 58 today, which, for our American listeners, is what is colloquially known as unbelievably and it appears that those fans have rather lost that enthusiasm and have turned it into aggressive violence against the opposition. So, bad day for Bangladesh cricket, John. So, that's it for this week. We've got a week off next week, and then the following week I'll be talking to you from Chennai, or as it's pronounced, Madras. So it's interesting, actually. All the Indian names, place names have changed as the era of British rule disappears further and further into the slightly guilt-ridden swamp of the past. But it seems that all the Indian people still use the old names, and it's only British people who call Bangalore Bengaluru under some kind of sense of apology.
Yeah. Whoopsie. Whoopsie daisy, Andy.
Oh, dear. We would bring the Tigers back, but they're awfully flat these days, and some they're of those tusks.
There seems to have been a minor snafu.
It's very hard to put a tusk back on an elephant, so, I mean, is it worth bringing them back? That's all then for this week. We'll be back with a real Bugle in 2 weeks. Next week, Chris is going to hack together something out of bits that aren't very good. So do tune in for that. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a lovely week.